Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Palmemordet. We got this. Med Schiaffino Musara.
Sveriges statsminister Olof Palme är död.
90 000.
Ja, det är mord på Sveavägen.
Hörde de säger att det är Palme som är skjuten.
Mordvapnet med säkerhet i en Smith & Wesson, en revolver kaliber .357.
Inte ett svar. Finns inte ett svar. För jag har inget. Och jag har inte varit. Varför ska jag?
Polisen söker en man i 35-40-årsåldern med mörkt hår och lång mörk rock.
Välkomna till podden Palmemordet som idag görs av mig, Tobias Henriksson på PRS Media. Vill du bidra till podden och se till att vi kan ge oss i kast med fler stora spår? Eller vill du kanske höra mer om polisspåret? Oavsett vilket så har du möjlighet att gå in på patreon.com/palmemordet och skänka en summa som vi får per publicerat avsnitt. De stora spåren kommer att avverkas efterhand som de finansieras. Och om det blir ett fall i sponsringen, som till exempel under den pandemi som drabbat världen när det här spelas in, så återupptar vi spåret så snart vi är tillbaka på grundnivån på Patreon. För ett tag sedan gjorde vi ett program om musik som influerats av Palmemordet och utredningen. Idag kommer vi att fortsätta titta på hur mordgåtan påverkar populärkulturen, men med en helt annan vinkel. För i vår kommer nämligen en mörk komedi om mordet på Olof Palme att sändas i SVT. Idén kommer från amerikanen Schiaffino Musara, som numera är bosatt och verksam i Sverige. Serien heter We Got This och har premiär på SVT den 3 maj 2020. Men mer om det kommer du att höra i själva intervjun. Då Schiaffino och helst tala engelska kommer intervjun att genomföras på det språket. De allra flesta av er hänger säkert med, men skulle ni ha svårt att höra vad som sägs kan ni söka efter Palmemordets sida på YouTube. Där kommer vi att lägga upp en textad version av intervjun. Och innan ni påpekar det väljer jag att säga det själv. Min engelska är inte perfekt på något sätt, men jag hoppas att ni ändå kan hänga med i intervjun. Med eller utan text. Jag började med att be Schiaffino att berätta lite om sig själv och sin bakgrund, då många svenskar kanske inte är så bekanta med honom.
I was actually born in outside of Atlanta, Georgia, in the southern part of the US, a little town called Marietta. And the short version of how I wound up here was that I started out as an actor in my early 20s, and I did a lot of theater and stuff like that, and I was pretty eager to get away from my hometown. So I moved to Boston, mm-hmm. lived there for about a year, and then hooked up with a buddy of mine who was in film school. And while I was there, in film, he was in film school, and I started taking classes to learn screenwriting. So I was acting and writing and doing all that kind of stuff. But I was still in my like early 20s, so I didn't really know what the hell I was doing with my life, or what I didn't know how to manage any of that or turn it into anything in particular. But then eventually we moved to New York, and New York is where I met my Swedish wife. We met at this very bizarre audition that turned out it was an audition. It was a callback for a movie, but it actually turned out to be a party. But it's one of the, normally you go in for a callback, you know, oh, here's the pages, you read this, blah, blah, blah. But you showed up and it was just like a loft in New York. And they're like, yeah, it's a party and just act natural and have a good time. The financiers are paying for the party. Like, we'll tell you at the end of the night, like, if you got the part. And anyway, I was like, okay, fine. It's open bar, free food. There's a band playing. And within 5-10 minutes of being there, I met this smoking hot Swedish girl. I'd never met anybody Swedish in my entire life. I mean, I couldn't find Sweden on a map at the time when I met my wife. But we became friends very quickly. And I guess we sort of hung out and became friends for about 2 months or so before we started dating. And then she, like a lot of, you know, people from outside of the country, her visa was kind of coming to a close, and we'd only been together for maybe 6 months, and I was like, you know what, I can't, I would never ask this woman to marry me after 6 months, but I know that I love her. Let's just roll the dice and see what happens. What's the worst thing that could happen? We could get divorced. We just had our 21st wedding anniversary. We have two kids. So it turned out to be probably the smartest decision I ever made, actually. And if there's anyone who I can credit with having just even introduced me to Olof Palme, it would be her. Because the first time I ever saw Olof Palme's face, I remember, was on that trip when we came here, 1999. We came here to get married. And I think it was around the same time they had recently found, I can't pronounce this, I'm terrible at pronouncing things in Swedish, but what was this? They found a gun in a lake. Christ, I can't. I've been here for 13 years and my Swedish is embarrassingly bad. But anyway, it was right around the same time. And it was one of those, you know, when you go to the Pressbyrån, you know, you got the headline there. And it was a picture of Olof Palme and a picture of the gun. And I think there was also a picture of a lake or something. And I was like, babe, what the hell is this? Who's that? She's like, what do you mean, who's that? That's Olof Palme. I'm like, yeah, but... I don't know who that is. How do you not know Olof Palme? You know, in America, I was obviously, I was only 11 at the time when Palme was killed. But also, when you grow up in America, you get very used to kind of being in this bubble where you don't hear a lot of news about what's happening in the rest of the world. And at the time when Palme died, you know, being 11, I wasn't really reading the newspapers back then in the same way that I do now. So she's the one who kind of turned me on to it. And she gave me sort of the short version, you know, that kind of enough for me to realize it was basically kind of Sweden's version of JFK. But the thing that I thought was so unique about it, I mean, whether you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK is kind of irrelevant, because they did actually close that case. So let's fold it up. We're done. Of course, conspiracy theories and all that stuff popped up, and lots of people don't believe the official story. But there's nobody. It was years later that I really came to understand the uniqueness of the Palme case, in that it's still open. And then, of course, stumbling onto this thing about the 50 million. Swedish crown reward was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. Because I think of everything from an American perspective. If there was a $50 million reward for anyone who could solve the murder of JFK, I mean, the chaos and insanity that would be swimming around that, even after 30 some odd years, I mean, it would be nuts. There'd be a whole cottage industry built around solving the JFK murder if there was a big reward like that.
Yeah.
And I just found it a little fascinating that there was really just kind of only a small handful of people in Sweden who still cared.
Mm-hmm.
And not even necessarily about the reward, but...
But about the closure of the case more? Or about getting someone convicted?
Yeah, the thing that shocked me the most was how few people even really... knew who he was, what he was about.
Sure.
My kids, they don't teach it in school. I mean, I saw the way they teach the Palma legacy, the assassinate. I mean, it's literally like two paragraphs. I mean, something felt very like strange to me. Like, why? I mean, I get that because the case is still open, it's rather embarrassing that it hasn't been solved. So, you know, that qualifies as something you'd like to sweep under the rug, but at the same time, it's like, Jesus, guys, come on.
Yeah. But let's put it in perspective. No problem. I was just thinking, because as you say, you don't hear or learn much about Palme as a person or Olof Palme, the murder case in school. But if we look at the U.S. and the John F. Kennedy case, is it different somewhat? Do you read about it in school, in history class or something?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, they might, I think it's also quite regional too. Like, you know, where I grew up, maybe they might not talk about it as much as maybe kids who go to school in Massachusetts, which is where Kennedy was from.
Sure.
But I can say I am from the same town that Martin Luther King is from.
Yeah.
He was also from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, when his birthday, I mean, we have a national holiday for Martin Luther King Day.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's like the fact that they don't have a national, I mean, and especially considering the fact that you Swedes, you love your red days, right? You guys love a freaking day off
for
just the dumbest things ever. What is the one that's like 13 days after Christmas?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah, 13 days.
We're going to celebrate that one.
Why the fuck can't you have Olof Palme Day?
Yeah, sure.
Instead of 13 days after Christmas. That's the dumbest holiday I've ever heard. I get it. Everybody likes to take a day off. Yeah, I'm with you on that. But it seems like if you're going to bother to have a day off, it should be for something kind of important.
Yeah, sure. And it was, you can hate him or love him, but he was an important person. He was an important politician. And, I mean, I'm with you on that. I never thought of that before, that we don't... We don't, what should I say, protect his legacy. But you're absolutely right about that. But
Whether you love him or hate him, he put Sweden on the world stage.
Sure, sure.
I mean, that's absolutely. That's a fact.
But your fascination for the Olof Palme case, it was introduced to you by Swedish newspapers and your wife, basically.
Well, actually, so the funny part of the story, which kind of led to me coming up with this idea for a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So I was introduced to Palme back in 99 and largely kind of forgot about him. After we got married, we went back to the States and we lived there for a while. I moved here in 2006 to Stockholm. And I sort of stumbled into the movie business, TV business, and started working a lot with lots of different things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes as a writer, sometimes as a director, sometimes as a DOP filming. Anyway, I started my Swedish company, I think it was probably 2008 maybe. And I've had a situation where I had a really good year financially, followed by a really bad year.
Okay.
And I had misunderstood the whole Swedish tax system, which I later learned was a pretty common mistake, actually.
Yeah, sure.
I thought I had already paid taxes for the good year.
Yeah.
I thought I was paying as I was going.
Sure.
And then in the middle of the bad year, my accountant contacts me and tells me, here's how much tax you owe from last year. I'm like, wait, what? Last year?
Yeah.
I don't have this. Like,
no.
And then that was the moment that I learned I was essentially in the middle of the bad year. I was living off of what was supposed to be tax money.
Mm.
And I kind of panicked because I didn't know how I was going to pay this debt. And the first thing I saw was a story about a, I think it was a grandfather and his grandson. They had a metal detector, and they stumbled onto some Viking gold down in, I think it was in Lund, actually.
Yeah.
And so they stumbled onto this Viking gold, and then they sold it to a local Viking museum, and they made millions off of it.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, that's, I need something like that.
Yeah.
Like, I need a big bang, quick fix kind of, yeah. And so I started searching for ways like to make fast money without breaking the law, basically. Like, how do you make fast money without being a drug dealer? And I stumbled onto this. It was like one of those websites where it was like a list, right? Top 10 things. If you found them, you'd be an instant millionaire.
Okay.
And like, it had things on there like the original World Cup, which was stolen in Brazil.
Yeah.
Never found.
No.
If you found that, you'd be an instant millionaire. There was another one. It was like a ship that belonged to the Vatican, full of gold. Sank somewhere in the Indian Ocean or something. I don't remember where,
okay.
but that was one of those where it's like you need money to make money.
Sure.
First you got to find it,
yeah.
And then it's like, shit, how the hell am I going to pull this thing up out of the water? And then I'm sort of clicking through this list, starting to feel like an idiot. Like, what am I doing? You know? And then all of a sudden, up pops like number six, Olof Palme.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Olof Palme? What the heck? And that was actually the first time I learned that there was a 50 million Swedish crown reward for anyone who could provide that information that led to the killer. And I got super excited all of a sudden. And it's like that weird feeling when it's totally irrational. But like for like a split second, I thought to myself, like, 50 million Swedish crowns, that's perfect. And then, you know, the reality kind of sinks in. You're like, wait a minute, I've never solved a murder case before. I mean, there's a reason why this case is still open, right? But that split second where everything seemed possible was essentially the basis of the show that I decided to write.
Yeah.
This character who when introduced to this seemingly unsolvable murder, looks at this 50 million Swedish crown reward, the botched police investigation after the fact, and kind of looks at it from the perspective of how hard could this possibly be? You know, this couldn't possibly be that difficult to solve. Yeah. Like, if you just give me a chance, take a crack at it, show me some information, I can wrap this thing up by the end of the year. No problem. Yeah. And so that's kind of the perspective that I wrote it from.
Yeah.
Naturally, it's a good starting point because it gives you the opportunity to, you know, when you write something like this, every character needs his own kind of journey, his own arc, right? He needs to start here. And things need to happen so that he changes along the way. So he goes, obviously, from how hard could it be to obviously realizing, oh, crap, now I get it. Now I understand how hard it is. And also kind of realizing that the murder itself, like what it meant to Sweden, what it did to the country, what it did to the people, it's bigger, it's more important than the 50 million Swedish crown reward. So that's kind of, it's a nice little emotional journey.
So basically, the TV series you are making are based on that thought that I can solve this, or maybe I can give, because the series is named We Got This.
We
right?
Got This, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was that the thought you had in your mind at that split second? We got this. I can solve this.
Yeah.
I can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tragically American, I guess, probably in some ways, where you're... A lot of Americans, because we think we are at the center of the universe, we kind of think we got everything. Like, yeah, whatever. Like, if you just, no, I've never solved a murder case before, but if you gave me all the information that was in the Palme Group, I guarantee you I could solve this thing.
Yeah, sure.
Americans, we have this, like, weird confidence about us that's completely unwarranted. Like, it doesn't really come, most of the time it doesn't come from any kind of real experience or anything. But that's the American myth, you know.
Yeah,
it's the whole story of America is built on lots of people who who in the early days of the forming of the country had no experience in doing what they were doing, and they just kind of plowed through and figured out a way to do it anyway. Mm. It's part of what made America such a great country, but at the same time, it's also what makes us kind of annoying on the world stage, because we think we can do anything. And a lot of times we wind up fucking everything up.
But say, when you saw this list with all the things we could do, when you realized, wow, this is a good thing, was it immediately in your mind that you were going to write a script about it, or how the process of from a thought to a script, so to speak?
I went through a lot of different phases, actually, because whenever you come up with an idea like this, I mean, your first thought is like, should it be a movie or should it be a TV series?
Sure.
And my movies are always easier to make in some respects because they're shorter. I mean, we made a 6-episode TV series. That's like making 3 movies, shooting for 60 days nonstop, over the course of 3 months. It's exhausting.
Thank you.
Yeah. But, and initially, I think I was going to try to do it as a fake documentary. Like, I wanted everybody to just kind of be themselves. Yeah. I was going to be me, and everybody else I wanted to be in it was going to be themselves. But then I realized there were, doing it as a fake documentary, it came with a lot of legal jeopardy, I guess you could call it.
Yeah. I can't imagine.
Pretending. I mean, you guys probably know that. I mean, I've always thought that was kind of fascinating when I started reading about the Palma, researching and all that stuff, and all the abbreviations that everybody uses, you know, like Policeman A and, you know, KB and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, why? What? And some of it's just to be for the sake of brevity, but in some cases it's because you don't want to get sued for defamation. And when I started to realize that, I was like, okay, this story needs to be completely made up. So I basically kind of flipped into a fictional mode and started writing it from a perspective of a guy who, you know, very much like my real situation, had run into trouble with the Swedish tax authority. And after trying to kind of solve that problem in some more practical ways, he sort of accidentally stumbles into the Palma case by way of this crazy cat lady who's putting up signs about her missing cat. Right? And he finds her cat, and when he returns the cat, she's not there, but she has her own private Palma investigation wall. And he's like, what? You know, he goes home to his wife, and he's like, what? This is a thing? Like, what the hell is this? Like, why are people doing this? And she shows him the, you know, the website for the official investigation, the Palma group, and she's the one who kind of reveals to him in the show, you know, well, you know, it was a big deal and people have a hard time letting it go. But then, of course, there's some people who just want to solve the case because, you know, they're only interested in the $50 million. He's like, I'm sorry, what? 50? Did you just say $50 million? Are you kidding me? And then he's like, bang, he's hooked away.
Sure.
So the first half of the show is kind of this funny experiment and him like trying to sort of stick one foot in, but trying to make sure that his wife doesn't think that he's completely losing his mind. But you know, as the show progresses and he gets closer and closer to the truth, keeping it a secret from his wife becomes pretty much impossible.
But because my experience is that if you stick one foot in, at one point you have water all over your head because there's so much information, there's so much theories.
One of the most fascinating things about writing this show was you realize pretty quickly that the line that separates writing about the murder of Olof Palme, whether it be for the sake of like a nonfiction type thing, you know, like a documentary or a book or whatever, to fictional, like the line that separates writing about Palma and actually investigating the Palma murder is almost invisible. And you don't even know when you've crossed it. Suddenly you're getting a phone call from a guy who knows a guy who thinks that he knows the guy who drove the shooter home. And you're like, why the hell, why am I getting this phone call? This is not, I do not deserve this phone call. Why is this happening? You know, crazy stuff like that.
I wish I got $1 for every time someone called me and said, I have a person who knows a person who has the contact who saw the murder. Yeah. I mean, and of course, some of it might be true.
Yeah.
It, I mean, the police did a really sloppy investigation in the beginning. Yeah. And so it might be true that someone hasn't been heard by the police. But then again... you know what I'm talking about.
No, it's,
you can trust everyone. Let's say that
the thing that, but that what I mean is that, like, once you've crossed that line, it's you're sort of on your own to sort of pull yourself back. You know, and that's actually a big part of what the show is about too. Is like, what would happen if you really sort of lacked that ability to sort of pull yourself back to that kind of logical side of that line? You know what I mean? Like what happens, and what happens if you cross that line and you go too far, and going back across the line towards the logical side is no longer an option? Then what do you do? Like, if the quickest way out of this thing is to keep going forward, what does that look like? That's drama. That's tension. That's
obviously drama. But is it when you talk about it, it sounds almost like a sort of a dark comedy thing. How do you describe the genre? Or,
well, traditionally, I mean, it simply stated, it should be called a satire. I've been told that I shouldn't call it that, but
okay. For what reasons?
Well, because I think satire implies that you're making fun of someone.
Yeah. Okay.
And I guess, I mean, we don't make fun of Olaf Palme. Quite the opposite. We kind of, it's, when you see the whole show, I think most people will see that it reads more like a tribute to Olaf Palme. We do spend a fair amount of time making fun of the Swedish police, which I think is quite warranted. Whether you think they're involved in the murder is totally irrelevant.
Sure.
But how they actually handled the investigation, that was the part that made me convinced that it should be a dark comedy.
Yeah, sure.
Because when I sat there and read just the things that were happening the days after the murder, it, for me, it qualifies as comedy of the absurd, you know, where it's so horrible that you either have to just go crazy or you have to laugh about how ridiculous the investigation was and how it all played out. So that's why, but that was not a very popular opinion at the time when I came up with the idea to do it as a comedy.
No.
I mean, it took over 5 years to get somebody to agree to make this show.
From
the moment that I came up with the idea.
Yeah.
And started, you know, initially when you come up with an idea like this, you don't start writing the scripts right away.
No.
You put together a kind of a synopsis of where you think the story should go. I had some very funny meetings along the way where people were like, wait, you want to make a comedy about the murder of Olaf Palme? I'm like, yeah? I'm like, I don't understand how the murder of Olaf Palme, how is that going to be funny? And I was like, well, the murder's not the funny part.
No, exactly.
That's not the funny part. I was like, the comedy of the absurd related to the investigation, plus, you know, all of the Privatspanare and, like, some of the ideas that they've come up with and some of the theories that I started to read, like... I mean, I couldn't, I know this, it's maybe you have to have a certain type of sense of humor, but the first time that I heard that there was a theory that Olaf Palme had faked his own death because he had AIDS, I almost fell out of my chair. I was laughing so hard. Because, not because, only because I just think it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. But it's so funny to think that someone seriously thinks that.
And the funny thing is that if you look at all the theories and find this one the most plausible, then, or most, I mean...
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't understand. I really don't understand. If that's the one, that's not the police. It's not the, like, Victor Gunnarsson or something. Who? Yeah. I mean, they have a kind of motive.
Yeah.
They may have a weapon. But no, he faked his own death. Uh-huh. An actor was taking his place at Sveavägen.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like a build-up for a good comedy.
It's the most absurd idea I've ever heard in my life. And I laughed so hard when I heard it. And I just felt like this, I mean, this is crazy. Like,
yeah, sure. If you do a sequel on that one, I want 10%.
So I think, you know, for me, it was the hard part about writing it, too, was that because there is so much information within the Palma labyrinth, like everything, all of the theories, all of the people, all the names, all the possibilities. Yep. And when you write something like this, structure is very important. You need to have like a really tight and clear and clean way of traveling all the way from the beginning to the end of the story without confusing the audience, mm-hmm. right? So that was really more like a trial and error thing. I think in the first versions of the script had too much information about the Palma assassination, and we realized as we started pulling things out, it suddenly became more readable and more yeah. more of a flow to it. So it kind of led to a situation where I think people who don't know much about the Palma case will be very much intrigued by the case-related stuff in the show. Mm. but it could also be the case that some of the privats, the people who know everything, while they might be excited to see the show, they might come off of it maybe a little disappointed that we didn't go further,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
We also had a fair amount of sort of legal issues to deal with mm-hmm. along the way. I mean, every time we turned a script into SVT, there was sort of an army of lawyers who have to go through it to make sure that we don't say anything that could get us in trouble.
No.
There's been a few cases over the years related to media projects where people got in trouble. I think Call Girl was probably the most famous one.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you got the biggest TV channel in Sweden, the biggest, could you say biggest media company? The big, at least one of the biggest
I'd say they're the biggest. I'd say they're the biggest channel.
Say the biggest.
Yeah. What happened was actually, that's an interesting story as well. So, like I said, for 5 years I pitched this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted to do it.
Okay.
No one. Most of the time when I pitched it, the guy on the other end of the table looked like he was like looking for the eject button. Like, how do I get this asshole out of my office? This is a terrible idea. I had people tell me this, you know, funny, but never. It's never going to happen.
No.
And there's something, it's something about my personality, I think, that sure. when somebody tells me that something can't be done, that kind of drives me crazy.
It's like a trigger.
Yeah, it is a bit of a trigger. Yeah. And especially because maybe it helped because I'm not Swedish, but the idea, I understand the nature that led to telling stories about Palma like this, like to be somewhat taboo. You tend to sort of, especially when someone's assassinated, you tend to kind of they become sort of like a saint.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And also, you know, comedy is a difficult thing to prove on a piece of paper, right? It means different things to different people. Yeah. And you walk into a room and I tell you I want to do a comedy about this. So I realized that I needed to show people what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So along with this woman, my producer, Anna Sophia, she and I basically put our money together, mm-hmm. and I wrote a script, a trailer script. We made a trailer that made it look like the show was already done. And when I started showing that to people, mm-hmm. suddenly they got it.
They got the idea.
And they also realized that as far as like, you know, again, we weren't making fun of Palma.
No, sure.
If anybody was the joke, it was me. Mm-hmm. The fact that my character thought he could solve the most unsolvable murder in European history.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
He was the real joke.
Yeah.
And as soon as people realized that, suddenly it went from one of these projects that nobody wanted to do to one that people actually kind of started fighting over. Mm-hmm. We quickly signed a deal with Jaroski.
Yeah.
They're the same company who did Vorti the New and Sol Sidon. And then I think it took a little while to get SVT to say yes. They were definitely scared. We pitched it to a few different places, a few different channels before we wound up at SVT, and I'm not sure why they said yes, to be honest. I mean, it kind of quickly turned out to making that trailer was kind of a game changer.
Okay.
Once people were able to see what it was that I wanted to do and the kind of tone, like the type of comedy, it's very, I guess if I had to describe, it's a very un-Swedish comedy. Like here, when I look at Swedish media, I think the division between genres is in my opinion it's too stark, right? Mm-hmm. It's either a drama or it's a comedy. Mm-hmm. And if it's a drama, it's very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a comedy, it's very silly.
Yeah, sure.
And in America we do that too. Mm-hmm. But we also have this tradition of kind of blending the genres.
Sure.
And the idea that you can and that was the thing that sort of surprised me that you know, I'd been in this business for long enough to see that mm-hmm. everybody wants to see Breaking Bad. Everybody wants to see Orange is the New Black. Everybody wants to see, you know, Weeds. Like, all these different things that are both funny and serious at the same time. Mm-hmm. But nobody seems to make those kind of shows in Sweden. Everybody wants to watch them, but nobody makes them. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And why is that impossible?
Yeah.
You know? I'd met plenty of people, writers, creators, mm-hmm. directors who I knew were capable of doing this kind of stuff, but it was the people at the channels who were always saying no to those kind of projects. I'm like, this can happen. There's no reason why you couldn't have that kind of show in Sweden. You don't have to choose between drama and comedy. You can do both. Mm-hmm. You can walk and chew gum. This is fine. We'll make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah, and finally, I think, that's the thing I'm most excited about. I'm hoping that this show will spark more shows like it, to be honest. Because I think the average Swede is going to watch this show, and they're going to probably feel like they've never seen anything like it.
But when discussing with the SVT about the project... did you have to change anything? Were they parts where they were like, no, you can't do this. You can't.
Yeah.
It was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You told me, but you haven't told the listeners.
I mean, well, first of all, okay, so there's a little trick that I learned from, I learned it from Michelangelo who sculpted David?
Mm-hmm.
Michelangelo, I don't know if the story is true, but the story goes is that he finished the statue of David. He thought it was perfect. The people who were paying him to do it were going to come by and look at it and give notes and you know, criticism and all that kind of stuff. So he came up with this plan where he took a bunch of marble dust in his hand And he was just, he had a chisel in the other hand. And when they showed up, one of the guys was like, "Oh, that nose is too big. Can we change that? Is there something? Can we try? You know what? You're right, actually. That nose is too big.
Yeah.
I can fix it." And he gets up on his ladder. He goes up there. He pretends to chisel away at the nose, and he just sort of drizzles some marble dust. And they're like, "Ah, it's perfect." Right? And that is something that you kind of have to learn how to do in the film business as well. And I did a slightly different version of it in the sense that the first version of the story that I pitched to SVT was the version I knew that they were least likely to say yes to. Because I felt like it was the craziest idea I could come up with.
Yeah, sure.
And it was all built on the fact that Olof Palme faked his own death because he had AIDS, and then we find him, and we bring him back to Sweden, and he gives a speech to the whole country, and he feels very guilty, and, you know, but then he apologizes to the country, and then as he starts talking about how much he's how sad he is about how social democracy has gone into decline, and now that I'm back, I hope to help, and blah, 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 blah. And then the whole show was going to end with like a sniper scope coming in like this, oof, and shoom, cut to black. That was going to be the end of the show. And the entire room went completely silent. Completely silent.
Okay.
Everyone looked at me like, what?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I would love to see that one.
I still think it might have been the best version of the show, to be honest with you.
So he faked his own death. He came back.
Yes.
And got shot.
And then we got. And then we essentially got him killed in the end.
So
I thought
actually
that was...
you pitched like
live. In person,
I wouldn't
in
say
room.
Worst case scenario, but a really far out version, so you can.
Yeah.
Then
this was after they
meet their demands. And
they had already said yes, we're going to give you a development deal.
Yeah.
So the way these things work is that your first thing is that they give you a script development deal.
Mm-hmm.
That breaks down in two phases.
Mm-hmm.
The first deal they give you is to write a long synopsis
mm-hmm.
for the whole series plus
sure.
the script for episode one.
Okay.
And once you jump through that hoop, then they give you the deal to write the rest of the scripts.
Mm-hmm.
But after they had already said yes to the development deal,
mm-hmm.
that was when I pitched them this. They were like, okay, well, we've seen the trailer and we have an idea of what it is that you're trying to do here, and you know, but what's the real story? Like, how, and then I pitched them that one, the one that I just said to you,
mm-hmm.
and they were like, okay, is there a different way you could tell the story? Yeah, I've got like a bunch of different ideas.
Yeah, sure.
But the reason why I did that is because I wanted to hit him with the craziest idea that I had.
Yeah.
Because I had a bunch of other ideas that I thought were kind of fun and crazy, but I wanted them to seem less crazy, you know, when compared to, you know, the first one. So it was just
it's a mind game, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can say that in some cases that worked out in my favor.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, we were really... There were a lot of things that I wanted to put in the show that we still were not allowed to.
Okay.
But I mean, now the premiere is in like April, is it?
May 3rd.
May 3rd on the city.
Sunday nights at 9.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good slot.
That's a really good slot.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But are you satisfied with the final product? Or do you feel that I could have done more with... If they had only let me do this or that.
I think it's pretty common that people in my position are very rarely satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
It's a creative process.
Yeah. I mean, I can say that I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a brutal process, you know, because you... You know, especially when it's an original idea. It's not, you know, a lot of people will write a script based on a book. You know, it's like, well, there you have kind of a roadmap already in place.
You know what to do.
But this story for me was very, it was also quite personal too, because there's a lot of my personal life sort of woven into the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
My father passed away like... 2 weeks before I signed the deal with Jurovsky to write the show. So I was going through all of that while I was working on this thing, and I managed to include some of that in the show. And the hard part is that, you know, for me, that's a really important part of the show. But there are moments once you get into the editing room and you start realizing, you know, you need to make some difficult decisions when you start editing this thing that you've made. And in some cases, things that are really important to me, like I personally have to sort of set my own personal issues aside and look at it for what it is as a project and realize that in some cases when someone's suggesting, like, I think we should actually cut this part where you're talking about your father, and you know that they're right and you kind of have to agree with them despite the fact
but
that you don't want to.
The feelings are telling you it's an important part, of course.
Yeah, because, you know, for me, I thought one of the important parts of the story was that I wanted this main character to start the story, like, in this emotional hole. Like, and he's more or less using this crazy idea of solving the Palmer case in one way is like this kind of weird idea that he comes up with that helps him to feel normal again. Like, this is how I'm going to manage to crawl out of this hole that I'm in, by doing this crazy thing that everybody says can't be done. And I've been there. I've done those sort of things more than once in my life, where you're kind of in that hole and you come up with some ridiculous idea that you think is going to kind of help you get out of it. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But yeah. But for me, dark comedy is the only genre that I feel like I'm really good at. And part of it is because I have kind of a dark past.
Yeah, sure.
I have lost a lot of people besides my father.
Yeah.
When you go through tragedies like that, it's the moment that you figure out a way to sort of laugh about it is the moment that you realize that you're starting to kind of get over it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like a healing process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's also the moment that you realize that it never goes away, but at the moment that you are able to sort of laugh about certain things is the moment that it starts to become more manageable.
Yeah, sure. It doesn't hurt that much.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So for me, like, that's what has always drawn me to not just to... from a creative perspective, but also like the kind of movies that I like to watch or the kind of shows that I like to watch. Like, I need them to be, even if they're funny, they need to be about something real.
Yeah.
You know, something that really matters. And from a Swedish perspective, I couldn't think of anything that mattered more than who killed Olof Palme.
Sure. You're originally from the US with different perspective. If a Swede would have pitched this idea, I know that you say the Swedes don't do what you say, blending.
The blending of the genres,
no.
Yeah.
But would it make a difference? I mean,
it's a good question.
You see it from the outside, somewhat at least.
I mean, it's a good question. I think the real sort of key to the ultimate success of the show being developed, the fact that it was being told from an outsider's perspective was part of the reason why SVT decided to say yes, I think. That being said, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I remember at one point I play the main character in the show. Back when I couldn't get anybody to agree to make it, I remember at one point I thought about, like, taking myself out of this, like, okay, so I'm not in the show anymore. Maybe I should just try to find some Swedish actor,
okay.
Like somebody who, I don't know, somebody who everybody knows. Because nobody knows me, right?
No.
I mean, at this point, nobody knows me.
I understand. Yeah.
I've done a few things here and there, and when this thing comes out, people, you know, maybe a few people will go, oh, I saw him, and I was in a show called The Inner Circle on Viaplay, and I did one episode of Hild Perfect last year, and, you know, what, like five people may have seen that? I don't know. Or a lot of people watch Hild Perfect, but I'm sure that, I doubt there'll be a lot of people that will go, that guy.
Yeah, but I mean, haven't we seen, like, Rolf Lassgård and stuff like that, being the middle-aged man, trying to find a new direction in life, trying to, I mean, in this case, if you would use a Swedish actor, maybe trying to, in a life crisis, trying to solve the Palme case and stuff. I mean, I see one of the great things about this is that it isn't based on a Swedish cast or a Swedish script. But you need to, I mean, we as Swedes need to look at it from outside and see how other people or other countries.
It's kind of a, it's a weird situation because you, it's a weird thing because you hear a lot of people, like regular people kind of in my business who, which is really not representative of the country. So I have no idea what the actual pulse of the Swedish people is like. But most people in my business are, you know, complaining about the fact that there's too many like cop dramas, right? How many freaking franchised Swedish cop dramas do you have?
Beck, Wallander,
You know, and they're all basically the same. Right? It's the grumpy old white guy who everybody is annoyed with, but he's also, he'd be out on the street, fired, and living like a homeless person if it wasn't for the fact that he's just so doggone good at his job. You know what I mean? And it's like, ugh, I'm so tired of that.
You sure?
But the thing that you don't realize until you get kind of deeper into the TV business is that they don't keep making those shows because nobody's watching them, right? People watch them. And not only do people watch them, they sell really well internationally. If they didn't sell, if you weren't able to make money off of these grumpy old men solving murder cases, these shows wouldn't, they wouldn't be so prevalent. You wouldn't see them everywhere. That being said, for me, from my perspective, I felt like so many people are already doing that. So I don't want to do that. Like, I'd rather have a character who is almost sort of the opposite of that. He has no skills. He has no background in investigating. He's not a cop. He has no access to official information. Like, he has none of the things that make a show like Beck or Wallander kind of easy when it comes to solving the... I mean, of course, they manufacture these obstacles for them to solve the case. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, how am I going to run a background check on someone? I can't, right? Or to run that license plate. You know, it's so easy in a cop show.
Yeah, it is.
You know what I mean? It and it just, it annoys me. And I was like, I want to do something that's like the opposite of that. It's very funny because it actually winds up helping me, I think, because ever since I've been to a lot of places to talk about this show, we competed in this competition in France called Series Mania. It was like a pitch competition. This is before we actually wrote the whole show. So at that point, I had a synopsis for the show, and I had this original trailer that I made to try and sell the show. And we went up against like 15 other projects, and I would say 10 out of the 15 projects were all like thrillers. Same kind of they all, if they weren't already Scandinavian noir, they were trying to be Scandinavian noir. Right? So they came from all kinds of, they came from all the, these projects came from all over Europe.
What do you say, created in the same form?
Exactly. They're all made in the same sausage factory, basically. And then I got up to pitch. I was the last project of 16 projects to be pitched. And to pitch this idea after all those, you know, once you hear, if you hear 10 thrillers in a row, they've stopped being thrilling after about number two or three, you know, because they all function on the same kind of machinery.
That's the roadmap.
Exactly. So then when I got up there and pitched this thing, people were just like, what the hell is this? And then later that night, they announced who wins the competition. And lo and behold, it's us. We won this pitch competition. And the jury was like, when I had dinner with them afterwards, they were like, I was like, I was afraid we weren't going to win because our project is so weird. And he was like, no, you won because you're weird.
It's something that a little bit different, a little bit. You're talking about France, for example. Do you have much of like a international interest for the show?
The company that the company, well, I don't know if they own whatever. Jarosky is part of a larger group. There's a company called Banijay. I don't think they necessarily own Jurovsky, but Jurovsky is just sort of part of their team, so to speak, right? So they have what's called a first look deal, basically. Mm-hmm. So if Jurovsky wants to do a project, if Benajay likes it, they can say, yeah, we want to help you do it. And they are sort of the international part of that operation. So mm-hmm. so the show, the way it breaks down is that the SVT owns the rights to Sweden.
Yeah,
to broadcast in Sweden.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure that Viaplay is going to own the rights for the rest of Scandinavia, mm-hmm. like Finland, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, yeah. all that. Mm-hmm. And then Banijay will be responsible for selling the show to the rest of the world.
Okay.
So that's sort of the simple breakdown
of it. Yeah, yeah.
And we've already started working on that. I was in London 2 weeks ago pitching to a group of distributors, and we're going back to France.
Yeah.
We've been invited back to Series Mania at the end of March to do a presentation about the show. Sort of a victory lap after having won the award 2 years ago and then coming back after having made the show. Apparently, we're the fastest to have ever gone from actually winning that award to making a TV show.
Innan vi avslutade intervjun frågade jag Skefino om det var något som han kände att vi inte pratat om. Och visst var det det. För när det här spelades in, dagen efter Palmevandringen 2020, hade Palmeåklagaren Christer Petersson nyligen gått ut och sagt att han skulle presentera en lösning på mordet inom ett halvår. Så här säger Skefino om det.
Well, I mean, the only thing I guess we haven't talked about is like the fact that they're closing the case for real.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that to me is like, what insane timing to have made a television show about some jackass who wants to solve the murder of Olof Palme.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're like, what, 2 months away from this show coming out? Mm-hmm. And the real head of the Palme Group comes out and says, oh, by the way, I'm going to close the case in like 4 or 5 months.
I mean, it's a good synopsis for a comedy.
Absolutely.
That one as well.
Well, not only that, I remember the day they announced that Christer Pedersen was going to be the new head of the Palme Group. I was like, this has to be a joke.
Mm-hmm. The name?
Yeah.
Christer Pedersen,
he spells it differently, but still, come on.
It's one T. It's only one letter T that is different.
I was like, this, again,
oh, this is going to be good.
Yeah, sure. All over again. But the fact that I really think that this is kind of fascinating. I feel, quite fortunate that my show is going to be, the release of the show will coincide with the announcement in some way. But I'm just so fascinated to see what the reaction is going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this last night.
Yeah, sure.
I think you and I are in large part in agreement that I think that the easiest way for them to kind of wrap this thing up is to obviously to pin it on someone who's no longer alive, because then it just makes it that much easier
Absolutely.
To close the case. But I almost don't even want to predict what the actual reaction is going to be. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because I feel like, I mean, most Swedes have by and large kind of moved on from this, right?
Sure.
And maybe they're going to react to it like, mm-hmm. okay, fine.
Yeah.
We stopped caring about that years ago anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the people who still care about the case, it's going to be a very noisy minority of people who are going to be really upset about how this is being handled, I think.
Because as we said last night when we did the Palme Vandring, the Palme Walk, they can present a solution within quotes, and it might be correct. We don't know. Mm. But you'll never get all Swedes or even all interested in the Palme case to accept that solution. Many people will have their own solution because they have for 30 some years been thinking that the police did it, the KGB did it, or CIA, whatever.
Yeah, take your pick.
Yeah, take
doesn't
your pick.
Matter.
Absolutely.
Whoever they say. It was like I said last night, for every one person that believes, let's say I personally think they're going to try to pin it on the Skandiamannen.
Yeah, sure.
For every one person who believes that the Skandiamannen is responsible for the murder of Olof Palme, there are thousands of people who think that theory is ridiculous.
Yeah. And I mean, I talked to people who said Scandiamannen is not on my top five list. You have like Christer A, the guy who shot himself and sold his weapon outside the Café Opera.
That one's way more convincing than...
Yeah, even that one. I mean...
It's so much more convincing. I remember when I read that theory and I thought, this is very, this seems quite plausible to me, but it would make the most boring TV show of all time because it's like, where do you go with that?
But you have the comedy. He went to Café Opera, you're sitting there sipping on the tea, and he has like a 357 Magnum and sells to a random drug dealer. I mean, it's, you must admit, it's somewhat humorous.
Absolutely. But I think it's...
not for whole TV series,
no,
but...
No, it's more like a... I see the Christer A story as more of a... That could be a feature film.
Yeah.
Maybe not TV series. But I really do... I'm so... I almost... Like I said, I don't even want to predict what's going to happen, but I'm just so... I'm really interested to see where it goes, how it leads, because of course we're obviously... I mean, this... we're interested in doing a second season of this show, and I mean, I've already started working on the story for season two, but you kind of, you sort of have to kind of, I mean, I can put together a basic structure for it, but at the same time, you kind of have to wait until this whole thing goes down, because it's really going to change how I think the story should be told, I think. And so I'm basically kind of playing around with different scenarios. On how to deal with that in a fictional setting.
Is there anything you can say about... Now, of course, we haven't seen the first series yet. We don't know the end there. And but, it. I mean, say, if they pin Scandiamannen for it, would you, like, do a scenario when you describe him as a murderer, this somewhat comical figure sipping on whiskey on his office?
Yeah.
And... oh, it's 23, 18, 19, I think. I have to go. I mean,
I forgot it. I'm supposed to go shoot Olof Palme. Damn, I'm almost late. I'll drink my tea when I come back.
I would watch that.
We don't even mention the Scandiamannen
in
season one because I just didn't think that was a very interesting. I mean, he's an interesting character.
Yeah, for sure.
But. You know, you realize when you write something like this, once you start talking about something related to the case, you kind of, the characters in the show need to follow up on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, it's just an interesting tidbit, right? Mm. And that's where you start to kind of lose the structure if you spend too much time talking about things you're not actually going to follow up on. And with Scandiamannen, I was like, well, I don't know where to go with that, you know. But I don't know. I think people are going to love it. I think it's going to be crazy. Mm. I think it's going to be like something that most people have never seen before. No.
And be sure to watch it May the 3rd
at
9 in the evening.
Sundays at 9. I don't know how
really
they're
good spot.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to release them one a week or if they're going to release them all at once. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Probably one a week.
I would say one a week.
Probably.
Sometimes they, as you know, they put on the streaming service all the episodes. But I think one a week must be the best one. Skip Mazara, thank you so much for coming here and for talking with us. And the best of luck with the TV series. We really appreciate it. And we will watch it. I promise.
Right on. Thanks for having me.
Därmed säger vi tack till Skiafino Mazara som vi alltså kommer att få se mer av i Sveriges Television från den 3 maj 2020. Fotorna från intervjun som ni bland annat kan se på YouTube-videon till det här avsnittet är tagna av Josefin Molén. Det här var veckans avsnitt av podden Palmemordet som gjordes av mig, Tobias Henriksson på PRS Media. För mer information om mig och mina projekt besök facebook.com/prsmedia.se eller gilla oss på Instagram där vi heter prsmedia, ett ord, små bokstäver. För att sponsra kommande avsnitt gå in på patreon.com/palmemordet och skänk en summa som podden får per publicerat avsnitt. Till sist. Stort tack till alla som kommer med feedback på facebook.com/palmemordet. Men framförallt, stort tack för att du lyssnar på podden Palmemordet.
Man hittar Palmes mördare om man följer PKK-spåret till botten.
För att ända sedan Julius Caesars tid har aldrig hört talas om ett mord på en framstående politiker som inte har politiska skäl.
Polisens och åklagarens teori var att han ensam hade skjutit Olof Palme. Och det ledde också till rättegång. Men han frikändes i hovrätten.
Nu ska vi ut på rövarstrådiga. Vi ska ut och röva.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.